We are going to hear Senate Bill 658 at the end of the agenda today and start off with a public hearing simultaneously on Senate Bill 573 and Senate Joint Resolution 15 on a public hearing. And I think we have a presentation from Kyle before we hear testimony. Yeah, go ahead and do 573 and 15.
Okay.
Tell us what we're dealing with here.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. To start off, Senate Bill 573, it establishes a task force on land value taxation to study land value taxation. The task force will consist of four legislative members and four members with expertise in property taxation. The Department of Revenue is to provide staff support, and it also directs all other agencies of state government in all levels, executive, judicial, and legislative, to assist the task force where needed. There are study requirements included in the bill that the task force will focus on, and it requires a report to be submitted to the interim committee of the Legislative Assembly no later than September 15th, 2016. And just as a very brief background, the idea behind land value taxation is just the application of ad valorem property taxes to the value of land and not to improvements. But that's just the one sentence background on a big issue. And then SJR 15 is a proposed constitutional amendment that would be referred to the voters at the next regular statewide general election. What SJR 15 would do is it would establish a land value lease fee. And that would be imposed on the real market value of land in Oregon, and then the proceeds of that. So it imposed the fee, if you will, is 4% of the value of RMV for most properties, and it'd be 1% of the RMV of land that's owned by nonprofits. So that's the two differences there. There are a couple exemptions for federal property, property owned by the state or local governments, and some Indian tribes as well. So the fee would be imposed on the value of RMV of the land, and then that fee would come in. A new agency is created to oversee the imposed fee and then also dispersing the funds. And the funds would be dispersed to qualifying individuals. So there is some information in the bill that defines qualifying individuals. And for individuals that are under the age of 18, the bill would require 50% of the fees dispersed to go to a college savings network account that is established on behalf of that individual under the age of 18. The bill prescribes that sections 11 and 11B of Article 11 of the Oregon Constitution, those are measures 50 and 5, do not apply to the new fee. And the, as I said, it creates a new agency, and the fee would be first be imposed beginning on or after January 1st, 2018.
Okay, let's see what this is about and invite Chris Nelson and Jeff Strang up to explain. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yes, good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Chris Nelson, and I'm Legislative Director for Common Ground Oregon Washington, based in Portland. And I'm also the owner of a small business finance firm for a little over 3 years now. And I have a background in finance, thanks to our neighbor over here at Willamette University's Atkinson School of Management. As many of you are undoubtedly aware, Chair Haas and members of the committee, since Oregon voters passed Measures 5 and 50, there's been widespread economic distortions and really inconsistent property tax obligations have been documented. No surprise to most of us here, I'm sure. And in meeting with most senators from both parties about this legislation, we've heard widespread reports of constituent issues with inconsistencies and tax burdens due to measures 5 and 50. So we know this inconsistency is statewide, and even I can attest to the pain of the inequitable tax compared to my neighbor's lower tax burden. And I live in Southeast Portland. Our study of Salem's early experience with measures 5 and 50 limitations and use of maximum assessed values showed that tax burdens have shifted off of rapidly appreciating properties and onto slower appreciating properties. And on top of that, statewide, the effect has been to transfer tax burden onto residential properties. And because Measure 5 limitations have caused local levies to go uncollected, the disparate provision of voter-supported services, as many of you are undoubtedly aware, has created widespread frustration and calls for remedial action. So fixing compression alone really leaves out a lot of the underlying unfairness of Measure 50. So how can we permanently fix these problems, as opposed to just adding a Band-Aid on this unlimited growth in property taxes? Well, considering the 80-plus years in some of the nearly 20 cities in both Pennsylvania and Hawaii that have used a lower rate on improvements, not necessarily no rate on improvements, and compensating with a higher rate on land values, we've seen several advantages if Oregon were to adopt this model. Well, one of those is similar to an enterprise zone where, of course, we abate the improvement tax for up to 5 years, obviously to encourage capital investment and expansion of jobs. This cutting the improvement rate removes the penalty for investing in capital investment improvements. So this is found to lead in, of course, increased building permits, but also redevelopment in commercial and multifamily zones, an increase in housing supply, higher lending activity, increased employment, and an expanding tax base. Secondly, adjusting the rate on land assessments upward has shown to cause no deadweight loss or drag on the economy, unlike other taxes such as sales tax and income tax, which essentially eat up the revenue source as they're used. Thirdly, economists explain that unlike other taxes, land taxation is actually capitalized into the price of land, so as opposed to added to it. This has an inflation mitigating effect, meaning there's a more stable real estate market and reliable tax revenue stream. And fourthly, when improvement assessments become less important, what happens to appeals on property taxes? Well, generally they go down, as experienced in many cities in Pennsylvania. So this has led to fewer staff and greater productivity in assessment departments. Well, there's even some economic theory behind this. and that is that value created in property legitimately belongs to the source of that value. Improvement value stems from private investment. So owners have the legitimate right to retain most of the building value which they have created. And conversely, land value accrues from public investments and actions like upzoning, as well as, of course, natural amenities and local advantage, population growth. But the basic point is that the community is justified in collecting its legitimately created value in land. Well, I'd like to jump to the three basic elements of the legislation before you. The study bill would address some core issues that really need to be assessed to provide a smooth transition from the woes of Measures 5 and 50 and to a local option land value tax. So a task force would study several questions, including how can relief measures, or you might say hardship cases, be addressed and designed in for homeowners that experience some large tax increases resulting from going to real market values, which would be required under this tax structure. So phasing it in as a two-rate would, of course, assist that process over maybe 5, even 10 years. But a tax deferral until sale would also afford relief. A homestead exemption is also an option. Secondly, what would be the revenue-generating effects of a land value ratio to improvements? Overlapping tax districts may have some problems here. So depending upon the overall assessment ratio of land to improvements, some districts might experience a decrease in revenues and others an increase compared to an equal rate tax. So that should be addressed. And thirdly, how would revenue growth limits instead of rate limits, as our neighbor to the north here already uses, work effectively? Similar to Washington's use of local revenue caps, might local entities adopt statutory limits based on rate of inflation or some other index? We really need to address these kind of questions. But the bottom line is this. The longer we delay tackling these kinds of questions, the greater the opportunity costs for these struggling communities that could really unleash productivity gains through a two-rate incentive tax system. So we ask for your support for this bill as the means of bringing about demonstrated prosperity for businesses, homeowners, and local governments. Thanks so much for your consideration.
Thank you. Did you have a presentation?
Yes. Chairman Haas, senators, staff, and assembled citizens. My name is Jeff Strang. I'm the chair of Common Ground Oregon Washington, which worked with Senator Dembro to introduce Senate Bill 573, this property tax study bill. I'm also an environmental health specialist at Multnomah County and a business owner of a home inspection business. Each year further we get from the passage of Measure 50 in 1997, our property taxes become less fair and equitable. Neighbors with similar real property values can pay widely different property taxes. One can be twice as much or more than the other. In addition, our property tax system is very complex and difficult for taxpayers to understand. We need a new system. To this end, Senate Bill 573 would study the effects of de-linking property tax rates on buildings and improvements, such as drainage systems, irrigation systems, and forests, from property tax rates on land itself. We've gotten so used to property tax rates on improvements and land being equal that we don't realize there is another way. But there are a number of positive effects from setting rates higher on land than on improvements. A lower rate on improvements encourages construction and renovation. A higher rate on land encourages development toward the zoned maximum, making best use of provided public infrastructure. In these days of human civilization covering almost all of the earth, land values are mostly determined by the public services provided, the legal uses society allows, and the improvements made by neighbors. In other words, land values are mostly determined by society. On the other hand, improvements to land are made through the initiative of individual owners. So it makes sense that we would want to tax socially determined values, such as land, rather than taxing individual enterprise that leads to positive economic activity. Taxation of land rather than improvements has been advocated by a number of notable economists and social reformers for over 100 years, such as Thomas Paine, Henry George, Milton Friedman, Joseph Stiglitz, and Peter Orszag. Land value taxation is practiced in over 30 countries and in some Pennsylvania cities. In Honolulu County in Hawaii, it was repealed in 1977 because of concern over too much development in Waikiki Beach, although it's really zoning regulations that determine the maximum development allowed. In conclusion, studying a split-rate property tax system should be part of our effort to intelligently reform property taxes toward a more equitable, transparent, and economy-enhancing system. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. I think we have about 1,000 questions, but that's how these kinds of subjects work, and I appreciate your outward thinking, forward thinking. So say we could snap our fingers right now and instantaneously have this apply in our state. What would you see, where would we see change, and how would you see it and hope that it would work?
Chair Haas and members of the committee, the way we've actually proposed this in previous sessions is through a referral for a local option. In other words, cities where this is most used in Pennsylvania as opposed to counties and in rural areas would have the choice to adopt a split rate or land-weighted property tax. So it really would provide additional choice for cities. It would not be a mandate.
Okay, so how would that say it's adopted then? What would you start to see changing?
Yes, Senator Haas and members of the committee. Most of the cities in Pennsylvania, depending on their overlapping jurisdictions, in other words, some of the school districts and county districts use an equal rate tax structure. But depending on the ratio, some use a 16-to-1 differential, some use 11-to-1. It really varies. But in virtually every case where this has been introduced, both in this country and elsewhere, one of the most immediate effects is an increase in the issuance of building permits. So over time, as the rates are phased in a differential, those effects start to trickle through the economy in the form of additional redevelopment, remodeling, infill development, banks start to loan more, construction in general starts to increase even beyond just in the form of remodeling and redevelopment. And in fact, the city of Harrisburg is a very interesting, you might say, case study of the introduction of split rates, because in the mid-70s, there were over 2,000 boarded up businesses in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And by 87, after they introduced and phased in a differential rate, it was named one of the most livable cities in the country by the RAND Corporation. And after 15 or more years, they added over $600 million in new capital investments. So over time, for example, in Pittsburgh, another effect has been apparent, and that is after 80-some years of using a split rate there, the owner occupancy rate climbed to one of the highest in the country. So in general, when you tax something less, you get more of it. And in this case, we can see that housing supply increases. And another effect is when the housing supply increases, that has a mitigating effect on prices.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I am concerned about, and I see possibility, and I wanted your thoughts on this, is that when someone improves the buildings, the non-land part of the property, the value of the land all around it goes up, not just the land that's built on, because it becomes a more popular place to be. Therefore, the land value goes up. So how does that affect people who don't improve their structures and so on?
Chair Haas and Senator Wright, yes, that's a relevant question. There are some dynamics here going on, of course, and the indicator of whether an overall tax burden will change as opposed to just a revenue neutral shift due to the splitting of the rates depends on what's known as the land to total value ratio. So if we're talking about, rightly so, some hardship cases where say a widow with a small house on a large lot, perhaps even adjacent to a commercial area where, you know, land values are fairly high and appreciating, it's very possible that the overall tax burden in those kinds of, we might say, hardship cases would increase. And so a critical element of this study bill is to address, one, what, you know, might be the scope of these hardship cases, especially given the widening gaps between assessed values and fair market values. And how can then we mitigate against these hardship cases once we know what the possible scope of those cases really are? I hope I've addressed your question for the most part there.
To some degree. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I might be permitted,
Chair.
Chairman Haas, Senator Riley, change is inevitable. And where we've got cities, that's where we tend to want to focus the development and the population density. So definitely as one property owner builds more for that density, you are going to see the land values in the surrounding area rise. But a bigger factor is the zoning. So, for example, in my neighborhood in inner northeast Portland, the normal 5,000 square foot lot is going for $160,000, $170,000 now. And recently, one block area was upzoned from R5 to R2.5, and that basically doubled the land values of those new skinnier lots. So you are going to always be seeing in a desirable place like Oregon increases in land value as a result of densification. And so as my colleague said, the main issue is ameliorating some of the negative effects of those, and so the study bill would look at that.
What immediate steps would you take, I guess, to deal with this compression issue alone?
It's Chair Haas.
Or in this, you know, under this umbrella theory.
Under this, right, structure. Chair, I believe if we had a clean slate to work from here in an ideal situation, the model that seems to work most effectively, and there's been quite a few studies over the decades since Prop 13 in California was passed, looking at both economic and equity issues associated with use of rate limitations as opposed to revenue limitations, and they achieve the same thing, right? Rates tend to mitigate revenue, but what we've seen in Washington State and other states that use revenue limitations as opposed to rate limitations is that there generally are not these inequities and economic distortions associated with those revenue limitations. And the complement to those revenue limitations would be to enable use of fair market values. So how does that work with compression? Well, in Washington State, there are statutory limits for revenue streams. On a statewide basis, say for education, there are constitutional limits. I believe it's 1.5%. So what we believe is that the study could look at ways to index properly such revenue increases or revenue limitations. It perhaps could be tied to, the consumer price index or some reasonable level, and the experience in Washington perhaps could inform us on those best options. But in general, we think that compression can be dealt with effectively using fair market values and revenue limitations.
Because we've been struggling on our tax reform work group on the property tax issue, which may be more, messed up than on the income tax side, when the central assessment debate helped reinforce our feelings there. And so we thought, well, maybe that's a really good place to start. And part of the problem is the necessity of getting a statewide vote to make any of those changes on 50 or 5. And so one of the ideas would be to go to a split rule, but do it differently, offer owner-occupied homeowners a homestead exemption, say of $100,000 or $50,000, and then make the necessary changes in Measure 50, or maybe remove it, or what have you. I guess if I'm using you as a sounding board, since you have some expertise on this, what would you think of that notion?
Yes, Chair, I think that would follow the outline of the study bill. There are certainly some questions about long-term adequacy and stability, looking at the possibility of phasing in a split rate tax. And I think we have enough economic expertise in this state, both here in our legislative revenue office as well as at PSU's Northwest Economic Research Center, to address these, say, sufficiency and revenue issues through proper analysis.
Well, the theory would be, if people are confused, they'll tend to vote no. So right. If people get a tax cut, they may be more interested. And so that's part of the reason for a homestead exemption. The other part is, you could arguably, middle class taxpayers are tapped out when it comes to taxes. The Haas family appealed their tax bill this last cycle, mm-hmm. and we won.
Oh.
And there's lots of frustration in the state over property taxes. That may be the understatement of the year. And it's not just that they're high or higher than the affordability might be for a lot of people, but that they're increasingly unfair. So we're looking at ways to get at that, but they all require a statewide vote to do anything mm-hmm. substantive. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Edwards, you okay? Well, thank you for your work on this and coming down and talking to us.
Thank you.
You're
Chair,
welcome.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I'm okay as long as I don't end up on the task force.
Well,
thank you. Me too.
Property taxes can be pretty dry.
You know how that works.
Until they affect your tax bill.
Yeah. Careful about that.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 573 and 15. If we have our team on the next bill, we'll move forward.
Sorry, I didn't realize it was 15 also.
Yes. If you have some other materials to turn into the committee, if they're written, that would be fine. Let's okay. Well, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 658, and I just want to make sure that the folks who are affected by this and who want to testify are here, and they're not here, so
what we will do is stay in recess until 9:20, and if they make it in time, they do. If they don't, they don't. Okay? So we're at ease. Till
9:20.
Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, and now we will reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 658. We'll take a presentation from Christina, and then go to Senator Johnson and her team.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 658 would allow owners of land in cities with populations over 500,000, which is Portland, that were disqualified from Western Oregon's Forest Land Special Assessment for property tax year beginning on July 1st, 2011, to request directly from the State Fish and Wildlife Commission the designation of the land as eligible for wildlife habitat special assessment. If land is granted wildlife habitat special assessment, the measure provides for deferral of additional taxes due upon disqualification of land from Western Oregon Forest Land Special Assessment if these are unpaid at the time of the application for deferral. So just to give you background, Forest Land Special Assessment, the land is charged according to a per acre value established by the Department of Revenue. And so the values are listed there in for every year. And then the land, if it is taken off of the special assessment, would be assessed at the market rate for highest and best use, and then with an adjustment for Measure 50. But so the there can be a differential in the amount of tax paid between the forest land special assessment and just being assessed as normal property.
Okay. Senator Johnson and Gary Grosnick. Morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I want to thank the committee, especially the chair, for his patience and the professional staff. I just frankly blew this one and didn't give Mr. Grossnickel very much notice to get down here.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. I had a chance to get a cup of coffee, so yeah. Thank you.
Well, let me just augment what the professional staff said, because I think she covered it pretty well. What the affected property owners really want is a legislative amendment that would enable them to obtain eligibility for a wildlife habitat special assessment directly from Oregon Fish and Wildlife without having the city of Portland request it for their properties. As you'll hear from Mr. Grosnickel, there had been a historic application of the designated forest land special assessment to their properties that was rather abruptly withdrawn. This amendment would not automatically grant them the assessment. They would still have to go through a process of submitting a wildlife management, habitat conservation, and management plan and having it approved. All they want is the opportunity to do so without a City of Portland veto. And I am very pleased to report that we had a very productive meeting with Mayor Hales and Martha Pellegrino and Elizabeth Edwards. Sorry, she's sitting right behind me staring at me going, how can you be so dumb? We had a meeting with all of them, and the City of Portland has agreed that as long as the bill stays narrow, that they would not object to this concept moving forward. And so with that, I would like to introduce my constituent, Mr. Grosnickel, who I just pounded down from his home with virtually no notice to explain the history and why this is so important to these homeowners that really started out with a conservation ethic trying to augment the ecological values of Forest Park that was just very abruptly taken away by Chair Kogan when he was the Multnomah County Chair.
Thank you very much, Betsy. I am president of Forest Park Neighborhood Association, have been for the last 5 years. It's a hard job to get out of. But Forest Park Neighborhood has, its land is basically surrounding Forest Park to the north and to the west. The City of Portland has a strip of jurisdiction right along Forest Park on the west side, and the rest of it is county land. That particular land, because of a decision by the county assessor, lost its forest deferrals. These are about 30 homeowners who have large lot properties within the city of Portland, but who have forest land.
Jerry, could you start off with your name and
Jerry Grossnickel. Address, sir?
No, that's okay.
These properties abut Forest Park. They're not small lots, they're large lots, and they have really good habitat, great forest lands. And for the purposes of our association, they're essential to keep the wildlife and connectivity for the park with the Coast Range. These lands occupy that section that would, if it were developed with housing, would cut off a great deal of those wildlife connections to Forest Park. It's very important for us that they not be subdivided and developed. At any rate, they lost their forest deferrals because of a decision by the county assessor who read a case called Entenmann, which is not exactly on point, but it was close enough that he said that because of Portland's really restrictive zoning laws, their ecological zoning, there is no need for, no ability for people to log because the zoning laws are so restrictive about logging activities within the city of Portland. And so because of that, the county assessor said that your properties no longer are eligible for these deferrals based on forest use, because you can't log your property. And so we've got all these big trees up there, and what's going to happen if all these deferrals are lost forever is that they'll be forced to sell their land and subdivide, and it'll be all logged. Anyway, so or at least as much as can be done. What happens is that when property is subdivided in that area, the city can set aside a certain portion for the house. Well, if the house takes up most of the lot, I mean, there go the trees automatically. So those laws prevent logging right now would not be applicable. So at any rate, what we're asking for is what the city really needs, in my estimation, and that is for these properties not to be developed, for these properties to have their forest deferrals or replacement in place. So I haven't explained this very well, but if you have any questions about it, please feel free to ask.
So we've got about 30 homeowners involved here. Are you one of them?
No.
Okay. And they lost their deferral on forestry, and now they would be given a wildlife habitat special assessment. Is that a similar?
They would have to apply for it, and if their property qualifies for this, it's rather difficult to qualify for it, but if you do, then you get a special assessment that's very similar to forest deferral.
Okay. What is maybe Christine could tell, what's a forest deferral versus special assessment for wildlife? What does that mean to a property owner?
Chair Haas, if you are signed up for the farmland special assessment or the forest land special assessment and become ineligible for that, then you can apply to have your land considered for wildlife habitat special assessment, in which case you would revert to the special assessment that you'd have when you had forest land. So it would be kind of going back to the same condition as before. The program to provide these wildlife habitat special assessment for conservation purposes is optional county by county, whether the is available. And so some counties have definitely opted out of the possibility of having this wildlife habitat special assessment, and some have opted in. But at any rate, it would revert the assessment back to farm or forest special assessment, depending on what type of land it was.
Okay.
Mr. Ooh. Chair.
If I could add, I think that the purpose is to merely allow the people who had had these existing forest deferrals but lost them due to an interpretation of the environmental overlay zones to qualify for the special assessment again if they can meet all the state agency standards. And the question was whether or not the city of Portland had veto authority. And in this instance, the city would step back and allow them to go to ODFNW and see if they could qualify. So you really have the question of the ecological values of these properties that abut Forest Park, where the value of the trees is the trees standing up, not the trees cut. And the way that the property owners were being treated was that they would have to cut the trees to be able to realize the tax accommodation. And the homeowners, when they initially went to Elizabeth Steiner Hayward and Mitch Greenlick, asked to have this problem worked there to no avail. We now have met with the city, negotiated this fix, and the city, as I said in my opening remarks, as long as this stays narrow and to these handful of affected homeowners, and we've tried to draft the bill in that way, it would restore something that they had before it was rather arbitrarily withdrawn. And for some of these homeowners that are on fixed income, although arguably on very attractive big lots abutting Forest Park, it's a question of fundamental fairness. Their tax accommodation was abruptly withdrawn, and for some of these homeowners who value the ecological buffer that their large lots form around the park, it will cause their taxes to increase by a factor of 4, was the highest one that I heard. So there's the question of the ecological values, there's the question of the fundamental fairness of to the taxpayers. There is the issue that the city recognizes this and is cooperative up to the level of the mayor in helping restore what the property owners did enjoy before it was abruptly withdrawn. Those are the issues as I see them. And I would ask Mr. Grossnickel, who lives with this, to correct any errors of fact that I might have stated.
No, I would simply like to add that these homeowners who lost their deferrals also were taxed with last 5 years of back payments. And that was a horrible thing for them. And what ended up happening, and I'm sure you'll disapprove of this, but several of them got deferrals under the farming deferral statute. And they have basically 5 years to prove that they can make certain amount of money on that property, and we know they're not going to be able to do that. So that's the holding pattern for certain of them.
Depending on what the Joint Committee on Marijuana comes up with, of course, there might be, there might be an agricultural opportunity.
It's a really interesting conundrum. Although even with the previous deferral or with eligibility for this, that still somebody could still sell their property and subdivide or log or do whatever. Correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yes, they could still sell.
Senator Burchard.
So these 30 properties, how many acres in total?
I don't have that off the top of my head, but it's...
Take a stab at it?
Yeah, 100 acres.
Okay, 100 acres. Senator Burchard. So the way I get it is, so we have woodlot resource property inside the city of limits of Portland, which doesn't recognize woodlot resource properties because
correct,
you're not going to do those kind of activities associated with woodlot resource within the city limits. So this bill would specifically just take that 100 acres and say it's a certain condition, it's going to be woodlot resource within the city limits of Portland.
Not quite. Chair Haas, Senator Boutsugar, it would say that the homeowners could apply directly to ODFNW. They would have to meet all the criteria set out by ODFNW, but they could go directly to the agency to meet the criteria without having to get the okie-dokie, technical term, from the city of Portland.
Or they might throw their hands up and say, we're just going to subdivide it and get out of here.
Senator, there's another aspect to that. The property owners, when they first came to me, oh, God, this is going to be an easy fix. We'll just go to the city and have them apply for this particular deferral, which is available under state law, and just get them to send a letter to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and that's all it would require. Mm-hmm. Well, surprisingly enough to me, that was not the case. The city was very worried about its tax base. And if it made a special provision for just these owners, how about other property owners on the east side of Portland, for example? Would they be able to opt out of their system and go with a wildlife deferral? And so that was the objection. And so when Betsy and I talked with the mayor, we were very pleased with their response. Is that if we can tailor legislation which allows this to go just to those property owners who lost their deferrals because of this decision by the county assessor, that would be fine with them. And so that's how it's working out, if we can get legislature to agree.
Mr. Chair, the city is in the back of the room, and while I don't want to put them in the position of, you know, being an advocate for this bill, if there are any questions of fact, Ms. Edwards is here, and I think she was in the meeting with the mayor and can represent the city's position.
Mr. Chair. Senator Edwards, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you. So the wildlife habitat special assessment is equivalent to the forest land special assessment in terms of amount.
In terms of money.
So it's not going back to the same assessment or the same category, but it's going to this back to the same level.
My understanding it is, but I'm not an expert on it.
Christine? Okay.
Would be the specially assessed as they were before.
Okay. And follow up.
Sure.
So, and then if I understood correctly in the conversation back and forth, I'm not sure who said it at what point, that decision is a county-by-county decision as to whether or not to offer it. Did I hear that somewhere? And so what I'm wondering is, if we pass this bill, could Multnomah County say, well, we're no longer offering this assessment in our county, and would that pull the legs out from under what we have done here?
This is city jurisdiction, not county.
City jurisdiction, but it was the county. Wasn't the county assessor's decision to?
The city of Portland defers those decisions to the county assessor about taxes.
You mean on assessment?
Assessments.
Senator Bertschinger?
Maybe to help clarify things, the deferrals are based on the zoning of the land. So you have to meet specific, you know, whether it's deferred for farm use, you got to show that it's being farmed. If it's deferred for woodlot resource or forest commercial, you have to show that it is being used for that. So there's certain conditions. You can't just willy-nilly. And it's based on the zoning.
If I may add to that, the zoning for this area we thought would be a slam dunk for this, simply because the city itself found that the property was valuable enough to put these very heavy restrictions on the E-zones, and so that basically you can't do much with your property because they need to be protected. Well, the tax situation makes that vulnerable.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I worked in Montgomery Park for many years, I used to walk both in Forest Park and in that neighborhood, just, you know, to get my exercise from sitting at the desk like we do here. And I would hate to see that property subdivided and have those trees cut down. The egress from Forest Park into the neighboring forest areas and back for wildlife is really important. It moves back and forth through those neighborhoods, through those large treed lots. So I think it's very important.
One of the arguments that we use to gain rural reserve status for the county lands, just abutting Forest Park, was basically that. Mm-hmm. that the wildlife corridors are absolutely important to be preserved in order to keep the park healthy.
Yes, yes, I agree.
Okay. Thank you. We, thank Forest you. Park's obviously a treasure in the urban area up there, and the perimeter is important too, and we'll try to figure out how to reinstall some fairness here to the best we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, I apologize and thank you for your forbearance and your patience, and on the record apologizing to Mr. Grossnickel for rousting him this morning and saying come down here at the speed of light. I apologize.
I hope you can return home in a more relaxed mode.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't know if the city of Portland wants to weigh in on this. If there's no reason to, then there's no reason to. So, and there's no one else to testify on this, and we'll take a look at it and give it time to breathe and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 658, which ends our business for today. So the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will adjourn. Committee will adjourn.